Joining me now is Russell Means. Russell has been for decades now a major activist in the American Indian Movement in this country. In fact, for a long time, I believe he ran AIM, the American Indian Movement. And I wanted to have him on here today because the only time Indian issues ever come up for most of us who live in the white part of America would be, you know, when the Chief Illini issue comes up at the University of Illinois, or when you're gambling on some Indian casino somewhere else in the country. So I wanted to get Russell on here to talk a little bit about these and other issues facing American Indians in this country. And Russell, I'll start by asking you, are you an American Indian or are you a Native American?
Well, I believe, first of all, anyone born in the Western Hemisphere is a Native American.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sadness, is that people do not feel that way. They don't feel this earth as being part of them as we do. You know, to be an American, you have to really know you come from this country, that your roots are here, that your ancestors are here. And for most Americans, the very, very vast majority, their ancestors, even if they're immediate, are here. So if they're first generation or more, they're Native Americans.
Okay.
At any rate, I'm an American Indian because I know where the word America comes from and where the word Indian comes from. America comes from an Indian nation, America. That's how the Spanish pronounce it. That's their name in Colombia. And that's how the Spanish named Central and South America, and it spread to North America. But the name did not come from America's Vespucci. Okay?
I always thought it did.
Yeah, that's the fallacy, just like Columbus is a fallacy, and a lot of the revisionist history of U.S. history and Indian history is perpetuated unknowingly on the innocent peoples of this country.
And where does Indian come from?
Indian comes from, you know, a lot of people were told, again, a blatant lie, that Columbus thought he was looking for India. Well, in 1492, the subcontinent, what is now called India, was then referred to on all the maps of the world as Hindustan. It had yet to be colonized, as well as the East Indians had yet to be colonized, the East Indies. So those words weren't even acknowledged in that part of the world, and it comes from because Columbus spoke and wrote in Spanish. He's Endio. He wrote, una gente Endio, a people in with God. Dio meaning God, E-N, in with, Endio. The Spaniards bastard that and changed the spelling from an E to an I and said Indios. And then the English further bastardized Indio into Indian. So that's the origin of our word, a people in with God.
And so you have no problem with me calling you an American Indian?
That's correct.
But you're not an Indian, you're an American Indian, which I think makes you probably the only ethnicity in this country to have American listed first.
There you go.
African American, Italian American, Jewish American, Mexican American. No, you're American first, then Indian.
Exactly, and that's another point I like to raise about if you feel American, put American first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before your ethnicity, and then you know you are an American. And then the divide and conquer, a polarization of the races in this country, will begin to cease when we're all Americans.
Okay, so Russell, do you consider yourself a United States citizen?
You know, I'm involved in a court case that I just talked to my lawyer this morning, where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just ruled a couple of days ago, either Friday or Monday, that Indians are subject to criminal jurisdiction or any kind of legal jurisdiction on any Indian reservation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we do not have any political input and we haven't any rights, any constitutional rights, either under their tribal constitutions or the U.S. Constitution, on Indian reservations. In other words, we are not being treated as U.S. citizens. So I'm involved in a case with the Navajo Nation that states that they say they have jurisdiction over me, criminal jurisdiction, even though they do not,
mm-hmm.
in my mind, because I am a U.S. citizen. And no U.S. citizen is subjected to foreign criminal jurisdiction or any other kind of legal jurisdiction except the Indians. And so that points out the apartheid in America. Now, I'm taking my case against the Navajos up to the Supreme Court because the Enos case was brought by a public defender. Horrible, horrible law. And that's why they lost. But I'm taking mine to the Supreme Court because I want the Supreme Court to tell the world that the American Indian lives in apartheid, American apartheid, that we have no rights in this country, and that we're treated, that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said is that the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction over us, that only the Congress. So we're ruled by communist theory. The Politburo, which is the Congress, has total authority over American Indians, not the administration and not the courts. So we're not under U.S. protection of the three balances of power.
Now, does this apply to you only if you're living on a reservation, or as you travel around this country, are you not subject to American law?
I am subject to American law, except when I get on a reservation, and then there is no law, and so I'm subject to the tribal law. In other words, if I feel that my freedom is in jeopardy when I'm traveling across this country and I come up upon an Indian reservation, I either have to go around it or take a chance of being persecuted and prosecuted.
Is that the case for you, or would that also be the case for me?
Nope. It's not the case for you because you have the protection of the U.S. Constitution. I have no protection.
Is that because the tribes have insisted that their land, we'll get into that in a minute, but what is deemed to be their land, their reservation, they want that land to be sovereign and they want to run it themselves, and so they've told the United States, keep your laws out of here, we'll run our own land?
No, that's not the case whatsoever. In fact, they're relying on the communist policies of the Congress to enhance their own control over just Indian people, unconstitutionally. There was two cases that reached the Supreme Court. One, a white man back in the 70s by the name of Oliphant, was arrested for a criminal violation on an Indian reservation in Idaho. He took it to the Supreme Court. They said because he doesn't have any political rights on that reservation, he can't vote for the tribal council, he can't petition the courts, he can't sue, etc., then he's not subject to that jurisdiction. It would be like an American being subject to French courts.
Okay.
You create a violation in French courts, they throw you out, except for a capital crime, of course. But they cannot exercise jurisdiction without consent of the United States. But Indian reservations, we don't have that constitution because the Ninth Circuit says only the Congress. In other words, there was a Duro decision, Duro versus Reyna, that an Indian on a Pima Indian reservation in Arizona was prosecuted under tribal law, and he took it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled in his favor for the same reasons of Oliphant. Okay?
Okay.
And what happened there, then Congress, the Indian tribes rushed to Congress and they said, oh my God, we don't have jurisdiction over, because there's been a lot of intermarriage, we don't have jurisdiction over these non-Indians who are married to our own members, so we want that. So Congress, in its foolhardiness or in its actual lust for power, passed a law saying that Indian tribal governments have jurisdiction over Indian people.
Okay.
Okay, now the Ninth Circuit has affirmed that. And the Ninth Circuit said the Supreme Court, the Congress can overrule the Supreme Court because Congress is the only entity in U.S. government with sole authority over American Indian people.
Okay, so when you're on an Indian reservation, whichever tribe it is that runs that reservation, they have authority over you because you are an American Indian. They would not have that authority over me because I am not an American Indian.
Exactly.
Do you, as an American, and I'm going to ask you a lot of questions here, and I think, like a lot of people who are not Indians, I'm very naive about this, so please excuse that, but I'm trying to learn here, and I inform my listeners as well.
Right.
So I'm going to ask you a lot of basic questions here. I hope you understand. Can you vote?
Not until 1969 and the passage of the Indian Civil Rights Act. Then we could vote for we could always vote in federal elections. Well, until 1969, we couldn't vote in state or local elections.
Okay. And when you're voting in a local election, that's not a tribal election. That's the local congressperson or mayor or whoever that is for that area.
Right.
Okay. Now, when you're on some reservation somewhere, if you're not a member of that tribe, that nation that runs that reservation, are you kind of like visiting, as if I were to go to France, I'd be visiting another nation? Is that how it is for you?
It's worse, because I do not have any protections of the U.S. Constitution. No matter where you are in the world, you have those protections.
Mm-hmm.
I do not. And that's one of the rationales my lawyer is utilizing, what's the legal term? I forget the legal term, but at any rate, the fact that we have absolutely no protections from the United States Constitution yet.
When you're on a reservation.
Right. Okay. And yet we are supposed to be U.S. citizens.
Okay.
So what they're saying is we are citizens according to their whims.
So, Russell, do you live on a reservation?
Yes, I do. I live on my own reservation.
Okay, and on that reservation you have rights, but if you went to another reservation, you would not have rights. Are there a lot of Indians who decide, you know what, I'm fed up with this rights and not rights thing, I'm going to go live out in the part of the United States that is not in an Indian reservation, and I'm going to assimilate into the rest of American society?
About 65% do that.
Okay. Do you have a problem with them doing that?
No, none whatsoever. I don't have a problem with individual choice.
And once they go out and they do that, they have the same rights as every other U.S. citizen?
As long as they don't travel on an Indian reservation.
Right. But if they're not on an Indian reservation, if they were born here, it doesn't matter how many generations back they may be an American Indian, but if they were born here, they're considered a U.S. citizen and have all the rights of an American citizen as long as they're not on a reservation.
Correct.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to understand this.
Yes.
Now, let me get to some specific things that have been in the news lately. And one is the question of sports mascots. Chief Illini, the University of Illinois, has a student who dresses up in...
I'm very familiar with it.
Okay.
Yes.
So you know the whole story there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, sports mascots, there's two things that I'm interested in, and I only want to address two.
Okay.
Number one is a hate speech, because having an Indian mascot generates hate speech. To give you an example, fraternities and sororities of rival institutions will, and this goes for whatever there's an Indian mascot for any college team.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is when their favorite athletic team is going to play the Illini, the sororities and the fraternities will put out gross pornographic T-shirts showing an Indian in an outhouse without the walls and sitting on the toilet, and they're saying, our Indian... we know how to treat our Indian.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that shows an animal, a beast of some kind. It might be the name of their mascot, the rival team, the rival university, and that mascot is fornicating sodomy upon an Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And those are on T-shirts, not just bumper stickers and not just paper cartoons, but they sell T-shirts with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what hate speech then does, it engenders hate violence. Everyone knows that
mm-hmm.
in this country. that hate speech engenders hate violence. And that's what has happened to our young people on college campuses, our older women. And, you know, it's happened wherever we've demonstrated, whether it's Cleveland, Ohio, or what, the Washington Redskins,
yep,
Atlanta Braves. We've been physically attacked for objecting to what everyone claims is something in our honor.
Yeah, and I've witnessed that personally outside Washington Redskins games in D.C., where there were groups of activists outside games for many years at every single home game,
right,
saying you need to change the name. And I agree. I mean, Redskins is probably the most revolting name in all of sports, and yet people say, well, it's part of the tradition of the team. You know, and we're actually respecting the Indians, yeah,
right, exactly,
with a racial slur. You know, we hear the same thing from the supporters of Chief Illini at the University of Illinois. They say, you know, he's doing an authentic dance that was taught to them by a member of the tribe who actually gave them the okay. But you, as an American Indian, must just be physically revolted by it.
Well, yes, and then the final issue is that if the United States of America and its population cannot see that and change the mascot issue so that there isn't any, do you think we'll ever get any kind of justice in changing American Indian policy, the apartheid policy? That'll never change.
Mm-hmm.
We'll always be forced to live under communism on Indian reservations. And that's what life on an Indian reservation is all about. This government perpetuates and sponsors communism on Indian reservations. We have no individual rights, whether I'm a member of that tribe or not. We do not have constitutional rights on an Indian reservation. We have nothing to protect us. Except, and then they institute the communist government that we're forced to live under, and the whole system of communism is intact within the borders of the United States of America, and they're called Indian reservations.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Russell Means, longtime activist with the American Indian Movement, just trying to give us a basic idea of what life is like as an American Indian here at the beginning of the 21st century. If for the other 35% of the American Indians who have not left the reservation, who still live there, you're painting a very bleak picture, and I hear bleak stories. But what is their life really like? What is it about that life that is so bleak?
Okay, you have what I call, I term the casino Indians, which has a false front. People think that casino Indians are automatically rich. Now, a few are. A few opted for a libertarian, or actually a free position of the profits actually going to each individual Indian,
mm-hmm,
treating them like a shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And because there's two bases of Indian law in this country, and this is horrendous, and this proves once again American apartheid. There is a portion of the Indian law that says Indian tribal governments are nothing more than corporations. Then there's another set of Indian law that says they're sovereign, that they're many countries within a country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whatever suits the government, whatever suits the judge or the collection of judges in the appeal process, is the law they go to. So we can never, ever get a just decision because they can pick and choose which side of the law they want for that particular case.
But in many of those cases, there are tribes who have been doing very well and sharing the wealth within the tribe with their members.
Very few.
Very few. So what do you think of the concept of the Indian casino then?
Well, first of all, let's look at the concept. The American Indian Gaming and Regulatory Act of 1987. You know, ostensibly it was to protect us, right? From mob influence, et cetera, et cetera. But not from crooks.
Right.
You know, not from people who just come in and blindly rob you and take advantage of you because of the laws on their side. But here's what happens. The investors come in, put up the casino, the Indians get 51% and the investors 49%. Sounds like a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
However, the investors, they take their 49% from the gross. The 51% then has to pay all liabilities. And then what's left over after the liabilities The remainder goes into the general fund of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, an agency that has proven in this last Clinton administration to have lost over the course of decades billions upon billions. They don't even know.
Why does it go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs instead of the people who run that tribe?
Because they are the trustees of our welfare.
And was the thinking there, where the white people will know how to handle your money better than you will?
That's what they said, but evidently they don't. Well, they know how to handle it for themselves.
Unbelievable.
At any rate, so what happens then is that money sits in that general fund, so the tribal council then has to write a proposal for the use of that money in the general fund. If it's approved, and the majority of time it is approved, if it's approved, then they send a letter of credit to a bank of the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, choosing, a bank of their choosing. And then the tribal council draws against the...
Against those funds.
Against the letter of credit. So they don't even see a dollar bill.
Unbelievable. So there's a middleman involved in this action, and while the casinos may seem to be making millions or billions of dollars on some cases, I know the Pequots in Connecticut have the largest casino in the world now,
right,
at Foxwoods. The most profitable as well. Are you telling me that most of that money is not trickling down to the members of the Pequot tribe?
Well, the Pequots are one of those that did allocate a shareholding.
Okay.
So, that's very fortunate for the Pequot. And there's the Dakota Sioux Indians of Minnesota, which have done the same. But here's what happens then. After a decade or so, the tribal councils who get in there all of a sudden become very corrupt. It's colonialism to its perfection. It's South American dictatorship to perfection. It's communism. And what happens is then they start eliminating their political opponents by saying they are no longer Indian. It's called disenrolling. They're no longer enrolled Indians on their reservation in their nation.
You can do that? You can just decide, okay, you've been an Indian your whole life, but you're not as of Tuesday.
They can split up families. I know from Mount Pleasant Chippewa Reservation in the state of Michigan, I know a woman, a Chippewa woman, whose mother is very strong, but her mother happened to be on the other side, on the political side of the existing tribal government, but some of the children weren't, and they were disenrolled. And you know what the federal court said then?
What?
Oh, the Indian tribe is sovereign. They can make up their own decision.
Sure.
And so this is our dilemma. There, you know, and it happens over and over again, you know, and there's no, my tribe for existence. For example, we put up this pathetic tent that serves as a casino. We're in a very rural area. Hardly anybody goes there. But it was projected that it was going to make $3 million profit. So what did the tribal council do? They not only went ahead and spent that $3 million, they borrowed $3 million more against it before the first year.
Mm.
So now my tribe is in perpetual debt to the casino.
And this is because of the way the tribe itself is running it, or the tribal...
Exactly.
The tribal elders, what are they called? The tribal council. The council, okay. So they're bad business people.
Right. Now get this. So the elders of the tribe physically held a demonstration and took over the tribal council headquarters. And they got the copies, the hard drive, all the evidence, turned it over to the Justice Department and the FBI. And guess what has happened? This was a year and 7 months ago this happened.
Well, I'm going to guess that nothing's happened.
Exactly. Exactly. And they even put out the elders, while they were in there, through the fax machines and copying machines, the evidence, and they passed it out to the people on the reservation. So the people on the reservation got to see the physical evidence of graft and corruption, the same evidence the FBI got, and yet nothing. No, a grand jury was called, and then they dissipated. They were just released. No indictments.
Unbelievable. But it sounds to me, Russell, like a lot of the problems that Indians are having are being caused by crooked, corrupt Indians who are running a lot of these tribes. Am I getting the right message here?
You're getting it. Communism's working on the reservation.
And so you,
for those few.
And you can't take action against them because the U.S. justice system doesn't recognize you as a member of the U.S. justice system.
There you go. You got it. Hit the nail on the head. You said it better than I could.
Why would anybody stay on the reservation?
Well, there is some beauty there. Number one, there's our music. Number two, our language, our customs, our culture, and the bones of our ancestors. We mm-hmm. feel for that land like all Americans should feel. And that's why we stay there. That's our cultural world.
In the hope that this crooked, corrupt system will turn itself upside down.
In the hope that the United States of America will live up to its own laws. That's all we ask. That's all we ask from America, is that you live up to your own laws. If we're U.S. citizens, okay, prove it. If we're not U.S. citizens, okay, prove it. But we do not want this no man's land, this vacuum that we're in, where we haven't any rights, where we have no redress. We can't go anywhere. Imagine if you yourself, or any one of your non-Indian listeners, that they had to petition Congress for every decision, every right and wrong.
Talking with Russell Means, longtime activist in the American Indian Movement, who's been talking about the problems on the reservations, where 35% of the American Indian population lives now. The other 65% have moved out and assimilated themselves and live elsewhere in the United States. But I guess the other 35%, yourself included, are hoping to be able to change things from within and help have the U.S. government help you in changing it from without. Would you like to have the concept of the tribe and the tribal council running the lands eliminated completely?
Actually, what I would propose to the U.S. government, and it's been proposed by other people also, time and again, throughout our relationship with the federal government, is that they should deal with each and every Indian nation individually. They'll be surprised. Most of them would opt for probably the status quo. However, I would say just simply that the United States of America has to get off the fence and either make a decision one way. We are either U.S. full U.S. citizens or not. You know, I don't go for apartheid in America.
Gotcha.
But more importantly, I also live half-time, actually a little bit more than half-time, I live in New Mexico. And I'm running for governor of this state. And the reason I am running for governor is because I want my people to be free.
Mm-hmm.
But in order for my people to be free, Americans have to be free. And believe me, every policy you see that's being foisted upon the American people now, in fact, forced on the American people, you take health, HMOs, taken directly from Indian Health Service and the policies thereof on the reservation. That policy of the HMOs, where now you can't, they're debating whether you can sue them or not,
mm-hmm.
taking a basic right of protection away from the American people. See, we don't have that right. So there you go. You have that in agricultural policy. The family farmer and the family rancher is no longer needed on the land. They're in the way. They need corporate, communistic type of governance of the land now, and they want the individual family farmer and rancher off the land. So those policies were first born with Indian policy. And you have your rights. You know, the rights, the federal government has now taken all the rights away from the local people, the families, the communities, the individuals of this country. The whole concept of the United States of America came from us, and that concept is individual liberty through representative government. Individual liberty through representative government. And that's why I'm running for governor of New Mexico, because I'm going to kick out, legally, with the New Mexico's Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, I'm going to kick the federal government out of New Mexico.
You're going to kick the federal government out of New Mexico?
Yes, and return New Mexico to the New Mexican people. And that's it. That's what we have to do in America if we're not going to be ridiculed before the world with every presidential election and every president now. You know, it's becoming a joke. American presidents are the laughing stock of the world. First Clinton, well, you can go all the way back to Nixon, and now you've got a guy who lost is our president. That's not a democracy. That's not a republic.
All right, let me get off the politics for just a minute here and get back to issues that I'm trying to understand about the world that you live in, the American Indian world. Do American Indians suffer from racial profiling?
Oh, very much so, especially in and around an Indian reservation. I mean, for example, I was up in northern Minnesota on the Red Lake, the Chippewa Red Lake Indian Reservation. And they have their own license plates that they proved in court. In fact, there's about 11 or 12 Indian nations in different states across the country that have, through the court system, garnered their right to issue their own license plates. But that's like a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they see you, your car has to be in perfect running condition, and as you know in America, you better have your seatbelt on, and you'll go, or else you go to jail, according to the Supreme Court. And everything has to be, of course, copacetic, because you're going to be pulled over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very prevalent in and around Indian country. Now, once you get out into the metropolitan areas, it's not that prevalent, but we really suffer from racial profiling.
Have you been hassled a lot by the police, the FBI, et cetera? I would think as an activist, you probably have been.
I have been, but once I came out against communism in 1980, that really, really began to dissipate. But I have been racially profiled on traffic tickets. And I'm one of those people who will fight a traffic ticket if I feel it's unjustly given.
Can you do that with legal representation as an American Indian in a U.S. court?
Yes, I can, but usually I do it myself.
Gotcha. Okay, again, more issues I'd like to talk about here. I hear that on Indian reservations in this country, there is a huge problem with alcoholism.
Very huge. Very huge. And it leads right into every debilitating disease we have, which the biggest one now is sugar diabetes. You know, in this country, it's becoming a very big problem. But on Indian reservations, it's epidemic. And 60% of the adult males over 21 have sugar diabetes.
60%?
60.
Why do the Indian tribes not fight against this internally?
Because they're programmed not to. The system doesn't lend itself to it. And besides, you have, which all Americans face, and that is the American laws on diet, and that you see it on that pyramid. And that's what the American administrations, year after year, put forth on American people.
But that pyramid is not causing people to drink.
No, it's not causing people to drink, but it's causing the symptoms, and it feeds into alcoholism. Understand, when you have a need for sugar, your body physiologically wants the fastest, your blood wants it as fast as possible. Alcohol does not involve a digestive process for sugar. That sugar hits your throat and heads right straight for the bloodstream. So consequently, physiologically speaking, we are programmed by the commodity food supply system the agriculture dispenses on reservations. We are programmed to be alcoholic.
Now, what does that mean? Who dispenses the alcohol to the reservations?
Not the alcohol. The Department of Agriculture dispenses what they call surplus commodity foods that the government has.
Mm-hmm.
Very high in starchy, high carbohydrate foods.
Mm-hmm.
which carbohydrates and starchy foods turns immediately to sugar once it hits the enzyme zone of your tongue.
Right.
And that feeds into the need for sugar.
See, the thing is, I love sugar, too. I drink, you know, a couple of liters of Pepsi every day, and I love my Chips Ahoy as a snack, too. But I haven't had a drop of alcohol in 8 years.
Right. But you're getting your sugar fix because you can afford it. If you can't afford it and you're dependent on the commodity foods system, you also eat some healthy foods. But when you're dependent on a high starch, high carbohydrate and diet constantly in and out, and then you suffer from poverty, low self-esteem, and all the ills of communism, alcoholism comes very natural. And you know that all poor people the world over look for escapes. Alcohol is the best and easiest escape.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, along with Russell Means, longtime activist with the American Indian Movement. Russell, African Americans in the last few years have been making a lot of noise about reparations for slavery. Should American Indians also get reparations?
If they do, enjoy your swim back to river.
Well, they're talking about monetary reparations for African Americans. Is there some, is there a movement within the American Indian community to push for something similar?
Not that I'm aware of. The thing we have are treaties.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, we want the United States of America just to live up to its own laws. That's all we're asking.
Okay.
And we've always felt this country and this entire hemisphere is big enough for all of us.
You like living in the United States and you enjoy the things that the United States offers. You just think in many ways it's unfair to your people. Am I reading you correctly?
Well, I'm taking a page from Orwell, George Orwell, and a page from William Shurer. William Shurer, well-known historian and author, wrote around 1950, give or take, that the American government will be the first one to go fascist. Democratically, that's what he wrote. Be the first government to go fascist democratically. And we're there. And so I feel that America, and because I'm an American Indian, I feel that America is headed down a disastrous path of over-centralization and the continuous repeat of history through a patriarchal history throughout the world of over-centralization and imploding. It happened to the British Empire. It happened to the Soviet Union, the Greeks, Egyptians, Mesopotamia, you name it. It's happened. Rome. So the United States of America is doing and following the exact same path, and it's scary. And what, when that woman, upper middle class, married to a doctor, white woman in Texas, went to jail for not having a seatbelt on, and then the Supreme Court backs up the police. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary.
Mm-hmm.
That is very scary. Now the police were told by the Supreme Court of the United States of America that they can do anything. So I'm scared.
Yeah, I spoke out against it on this show, and many of my listeners were as appalled as you are.
Right.
So I think we're on the same page here. Will you be celebrating the 4th of July tomorrow?
Oh, the 4th of July, no. I would rather celebrate the declaration the anniversary of the Constitution of the United States, which comes in December.
Mm-hmm. The Declaration of Independence and the birth of the country, as they call it, on the 4th of July doesn't mean as much to you as the...
I believe it's been utilized by the powers that be for their own self-aggrandizement. And it's no longer representative of the ideals of what the Constitution stands for and why this country was formed. Individual liberty.
Well, Russell, I thank you for your time today, and I know there are many, many more issues we could get into here. And I will put a link to your website from mine, which my listeners know, harrisonline.com, so people can go and read and find out more about this. And I hope you and I will have a chance to chat again, and you can inform us more. You've given us kind of a basic understanding of life as an American Indian in the country today, and I hope we can go deeper some other time.
Great, and I appreciate you calling.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Pearl, for setting this up for us. That's Russell Means of the American Indian Movement here on the Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS. More in a moment.